buy a cleanup after yourself, will you? He's so shocked he said something nice about somebody. He forgot what he was doing. Thanks, Bob. I'm Don Landis. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks for those kind words and your pitch for sainthood, I guess. And it's true. You know, I work for a living. I'll be getting home if everything goes right about 3 a.m. Monday morning, and I will get up at 6 and I will go to work, and we'll find out how spiritual I am Monday. You know what I mean? Because I know Monday, like every day that I wake up, the first word that I will have in my mind is God. And the second word will more than likely be, damn it. So, just telling the truth. I want to take a moment before I get too deep into my tale of self-obsession. Edie, thank you so much for thinking of me and inviting me, recommending me to the committee. Jody, for the setting the record for emails received for one speaking engagement. I got nervous. 4 days went by once, and she hadn't emailed me, and I wanted to call and see if she was all right. And Bob and Steve for supplying the humor when I, you know, you would think the fun part about this is, you know, you get to travel, you get to meet wonderful people, and it is, you know, it's an honor and a privilege to be asked to speak in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I'm from the school, I think it's an honor and a privilege just to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Just to be able to come to rooms like this with people like you on a continual basis and enjoy the gift of sobriety one more day. And this is a gift that for a long time I didn't think I wanted, and once I wanted it, I knew I'd never have it. I'd never make it in Alcoholics Anonymous. Come on, who are you kidding? Because I'd done everything I could to put down the drink. I could put the drink down for a little bit of time, you know what I mean? I could even walk away from it. You know, I'm kind of a one-trick pony in that regard. But there's something about that, you know, living life on life's terms, day in, day out, trying to be good. At some point, it just becomes too much work, doesn't it? I mean, it's a vicious disease we suffer from, you know, where, I mean, once you get that gift of self-knowledge and you know it's killing you, it's not mom or dad or the district attorney or the doctor stitching you up saying, you're going to die if you keep this up. You know it's killing you. And you make the decision to quit drinking. And man, when you make that decision, it feels so good. Whew. Glad that's behind me. Don't have to do that malarkey anymore. And it's great, isn't it? For like 3 days. By day 12, you're just like, I've definitely overthought this thing. And but I love drunks, man. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I get off the plane and I had a 5:30 flight out of Seattle, right? I live 2 hours from the airport, which means I'm getting up at like 1 o'clock in the morning. I'm out the door at 1:30 in the morning. So I'm punchy by the time I land in Atlanta. I'm not hitting on all eight cylinders. But I call my host, Bob, because it's up to Bob now, because I don't have much to offer at that point in the day. And Bob goes, you can't miss us. There's no way we can screw this up. And I'm like, okay, him and Steve and me, three alcoholics, this is never going to work. And sure enough, we couldn't find each other in the airport until like we were literally 15 feet from each other, both on our cell phones, like talking each other in. I think we're getting close. Keep moving. I think I heard him before I saw him. But I'm here now and I'm having a great time. I've certainly enjoyed all the other speakers carrying the message to us this weekend. Been fantastic. My good friend Danny speaking tomorrow morning. Just love Danny. Love, you know, not because he gives a great talk, which he does. He gives a great, great talk. He's a good man. He's one of my friends. You know, we call, we chop it up on the phone. We're human beings. And you know what I love about Danny? Danny gets it. You know what I mean? He gets that this is a gift. He also understands it's a gift that comes unassembled. And that Alcoholics Anonymous is the place we were lucky enough to find where you guys taught us how to put it together, you know, and I keep coming back because it's a funny thing about the spiritual way of life. You know, I can have the most awesome spiritual day you can think of. You know what I mean? You do that 11-step review at night and it's all good. You're like, oh, didn't you? I was just thinking what I could add to life, to the stream of life. I didn't miss any opportunities to be of service. You know, I wasn't even thinking of myself most of the time. And you can feel really good about yourself spiritually. And that's nice, but the next day it's like our spiritual structure is built out of sand on the beach. And you build that perfect sphere, and you go to bed, and you know, God sends the waves and wipes it out. You know, You get up in the morning, you got to start building again. You know, you got to start using the building blocks, prayer and meditation, try to get out of my head, direct my thinking, try to get out of, you know, I'm telling you, I'm 24 years old. My sobriety date is 9/16/91. I celebrated 24 years continuous sobriety last September. And I'll tell you, I'm waiting for the day where I wake up and I'm not thinking about me. You know, and it hasn't happened yet. I'm going to send a bulletin to GSO if it ever does, because it just hasn't happened. Every day I wake up thinking about me, and that's the real struggle. Is when I get up, it's time to get away from me. And how am I going to keep me away from me today? How am I going to connect with God and connect with His kids? Because that's the sweet spot. And Alcoholics Anonymous taught me how to get into the sweet spot, because I didn't know how. You know, I came here, and my story's unique. And boy, when I got here, it was fascinating. You know, most of us have those stories that are completely, nobody's ever done what we've done or gone where we've gone or felt the way we felt. And we're going to take a lot of that stuff to the grave, and then we're new in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know we got new people here. We got a bunch of people in their first year of sobriety, and we got a bunch in the first 3 months. And I want to tell you, if you're at a place like this with all these people here, and you're in your first year, well done. That is excellent that you're here, and I'm so thrilled you're happy. And just once more for me, how many people in their first 30 days? Can I see that, the first 30 days? Yeah, how's it going? Going great, isn't it? Not digging it yet, are you? No, I get it, man. It's tough. I mean, I'm terrified of taking that first drink. I hope I never take another drink as long as I live, but there's something that scares me just about as bad. That's doing my first year over, you know what I mean? But if you're new, I want to cordially welcome you here to Alcoholics Anonymous. We are delighted you are here, but we also know that if you are new, as delighted as we are that you are here, you may not be as delighted. And we understand that. And you might think, you know, what do you know about me? Because that's how I felt when I was new, and people told me, I've been right where you've been, kid. And I said, no, you haven't, you know, because you didn't look like me. You were cleaned up, and you had... man, Alcoholics Anonymous was full of show-offs when I got here. You know, they had stuff I couldn't even imagine ever having, like a valid driver's license. And and there's an address on the license, and if you go there, they actually live there. That's showing off. And they tried to explain to me how they had felt just the way I had felt, and I didn't believe them. But I'm telling you, if you're new, we know right where you are. We've been right where you are, and we know a great deal about you. You might think, how could that be? You haven't even met me. You haven't even talked to me yet. Trust me, we know a great deal about you. For instance, if you're new, this hasn't been a good year. Wasn't a good year for us when we got here either. Nobody gets here in a winning streak, and we understand that. And I wanted a reason that I ended up more dead and alive at age 31 in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And I had a story I've been dragging around with me, you know, for years, forever seemingly, before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's a story of that family I came from. You know, I had alcoholism in the home. I had a dad that left when I was 2 years old, said he was going out for a pack of smokes, and I still haven't seen him. You know what I mean? And there's physical abuse in the family, and there's a different uncle every other month, and I'm 7 years old, and I'm getting up to get off to school and get some Cheerios, and there's my drunk, naked mother and my drunk, latest uncle laying on the living room floor, and I got to walk by that crap, go get some chow and get off to school. And, you know, I love telling those stories when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I particularly love telling them to women when I'm out there, you know, getting to know somebody. There's nothing better than having somebody feel sorry for you, is it? Oh. Because I'm not just an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic / victim. You know what I mean? If you're going to live the way I live and do the things I do to people, it better not be your fault. You better have an explanation on why you're a maniac, you know? So I've been telling those stories for a long time by the time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and man, you get a sponsor, you know, and boy, if you want to stay a victim here in Alcoholics Anonymous, don't get a sponsor, because they will mess up your victimization too quick, you know, and they delight in it, you know, and the more you tell them about your sad childhood, the more they laugh. We're not big on self-pity here, boy. We know that kills alcoholics. That's one of our four forms of self-propulsion. You know, it tells me I'm driven by 100 forms of fear, self-seeking, self-delusion, and self-pity. Any one of those things can kill me. See, I think self-pity is wonderful because I always, in my head, if I can win in court, if I can sell it to you, if I can explain it just right and you feel sorry for me, what's wrong with that? Well, the problem is it means that I don't have to take responsibility for my life, that every drink I take with impunity. If you came from that family and you had that abuse and you had that dad that left in that gang-ridden neighborhood and that poverty I grew up in, you drink too. So you know what? Why don't you save your judgment for another day? Why don't you walk a mile in my shoes before you judge me? And that crap kept me sick and dying and stuck in a bottle. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I did the work and the steps. You know what I found out about my childhood? It was shocking. It's over. Old-timers are profound, too. I mean, the old-timers in Alcoholics Anonymous, I think they're the Greek philosophers of modern time, you know, and just 1,000 years from now, they'll be talking about the old-timers of AA, and they said to him, look in the mirror, for there is your problem, you know? We wouldn't think of that stuff, you know? I like the big book. I like the language of the big book. I like it says that we're not reformers or evangelists. You know what I mean? We don't have any, we don't got nothing against alcohol. Alcohol saved most of our sanity until we can make it to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? I had to come to AA to even find this out. You know, I thought drinking was my problem. Most of us do before we get here. And that's because we're not dealing with alcoholics. We're not dealing with sober alcoholics in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're dealing with people that don't understand alcoholism any more than we do, and they love us. It's a deadly combination. Employers and husbands and wives and children and relatives and doctors and lawyers and people that care about us and trying to help in the world. And so they try to take that energy and they put it towards alcoholism and they brainwash us. Everybody that makes it to Alcoholics Anonymous has undergone a successful brainwashing. And the brainwashing campaign has been carried out by the people that love us and know us the most and want the best things in the world for us. Why wouldn't we trust them? And every one of them says the same thing to us. You're a great human being. You're a beautiful person. You have so much potential. You could probably be anything you wanted to be. Go anywhere you wanted to go. If you just quit drinking. If you just quit drinking, everything would be all right. If you just quit drinking, you'd be happy. You just quit drinking, everything would work out. Yeah, it makes sense, doesn't it? Go to jail, I was drinking. Hit that guy, I was drinking. Lost the job, I was drinking. Didn't show up, I was drinking. Makes sense in my alcoholic mind. It's the booze. So what do? We have that moment of self-knowledge where we go, yeah, yeah. It's the drinking. That's my problem. Every good newcomer that comes to AA and reads the big book, there's a description of an alcoholic in the big book. It's one of the most inaccurate descriptions, but it is in the book. We threw it in there for that very small percentage of us. And it said, and then there's the alcoholic that's normal in every regard except for the effect that alcohol has on them. And every good newcomer goes, that's me. That's me. I'm a wonderful human being except when I drink. My first grand sponsor used to tell me, whiskey didn't make you what you were, kid. It exposed you for what you were. And I was quick to admit I was a liar, a cheat, and a thief. But I blame the whiskey. There's no way I'm going to be a liar and a cheat and a thief sober until I continue to lie, cheat, and steal in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you become open-minded that maybe this isn't about alcohol. Maybe alcohol is my solution and not my problem. You know, a very successful treatment for the disease of alcoholism is drinking whiskey. It will kill you, but the nastiest parts of the disease that I suffer from kind of go into remission or even disappear with a couple of drinks in me. The nastiest part of my disease starts when I'm sober. It got hard to try to explain that to people because it was a feeling more than an intellectual process when I was out there running and gunning in those brief moments of recovery that I would have of my own where I just wasn't drinking and my life seemingly got better and I started going to work 5 days a week. And my laundry started getting done, and I stopped going to jail, and everybody that loved me was telling me what a good job I was doing. It was hard to explain to them that I was going crazy inside my own skin. If drinking's the problem, then how come every time I stop drinking, I go insane? I hate the way I feel when I'm sober. And I don't know what's happened to me, because it didn't start out that way. Alcohol seemed to be an additive to an already full life. A kid that was a graduating class athlete, had a 3.6 GPA, had 20 scholarship offers to go play basketball, dated up a storm, kind of guy you wanted to be with. The end of my drinking, I'm drinking for oblivion. I can't stand the way I feel. I can't draw a sober breath, and I don't know what's happened to me in the interval. It seemed to happen like that. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I heard your stories, and men would tell their story, and they'd get to some part in their story, and they'd get all dramatic, and they'd go, and then I crossed the line. Dun, dun, dun. You know. And I thought, you know, when did I cross the line from controlled to uncontrolled drinking? When did I become a slave to King Alcohol, shivering denizen of his mad realm? When did that occur? And so I thought about the dramatic stuff, you know. First car crash or the last car crash? First time I went to jail, last time I went to jail. First time I made my mom cry behind my drinking, the last time I made my mom cry. When was it that I crossed the line? And I know today when I crossed it. I crossed it when I thought it was working for me. When I would have told anybody that would listen, I'm never going to stop doing this, why would you? It's allowing me to be anything I want to be, not feel anything I don't want to feel. It's magic in a bottle. I agree with Dr. Silkworth and the doctor's opinion. Men and women drink essentially for the effect produced by alcohol. You give a normal person that and you have them read that and you go, what do you think the effect is produced by alcohol? You will get a very different answer from a normal person than you will from an alcoholic. I did it. I asked one of my normal friends, what's the effect produced by alcohol? And in all seriousness, he said, well, you know, sometimes you have a tough day. Or maybe it's a celebration. And you decide you're going to have a cocktail. And you have the cocktail, you know, and it produces an effect in you, kind of a relaxation. And actually, sometimes when I drink, I start to hear the music better. I feel that beat, baby, you know what I mean? It's very pleasurable. And so I decide to have another drink. And somewhere in the middle of that second drink, I start to feel it, so I stop. No, you don't. No, you hit the accelerator. It's about to get good. But I don't stand that this is a normal person putting poison in their system, that once they get a certain point, their body starts sending them signals saying, don't put any more of this in me. I'm starting to feel nauseous. I'm starting to feel funny. I'm starting to feel out of control. I don't like the way this is making me feel anymore. Stop. And normal people just stop. My body sends me a different set of signals. It's really one signal. More! More, 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 more. There's an excitement. It doesn't matter what the date on the calendar is. I have two drinks. It's New Year's Eve. My heart rate goes up driving to the liquor store. You know what I mean? I drink essentially for the effect by alcohol. Once I have self-knowledge, I will admit that it's injurious. I admit it's killing me. That's bizarre to your family, isn't it? You go, no, I can't do this anymore. It's killing me. And then they see us drunk a week later. I admit it's injurious. But the sensation is so elusive, Silkworth writes. What does that mean? It means there's nothing else like it. Don't you understand? It doesn't matter how much money I make, how many women I sleep with, how far up I go the ladder in business, what kind of car I drive, how many people think I'm the man. Doesn't matter. Nothing gets it for a guy like Don like a couple of drinks. Love the effect produced by alcohol. And I have those couple of drinks. And it sets off a phenomenon of craving in me, an allergic reaction that normal people don't have, where one's too many and a million's not enough. And I don't know that about myself. So I'm drinking uninformed, not knowing that I have a problem. See, my alcoholic life seems the only normal one. It's all that I understand. But I get in trouble. And I tear my life up and I hurt people I love. And I don't want to live that way. So I quit drinking. And that's all I do. I don't come to AA. I don't tell anybody I'm quitting drinking. I just stop because that's what a man does. And Silkworth describes what happens to a guy like me when I just stop. In short order, it tells me I'm irritable, restless, and discontent. Biggest understatement in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, isn't it? Doesn't sound half bad. If I ran into Danny at a meeting, Danny said to me, hey, Don, how you doing? Well, I got to tell you, Danny. this particular evening, I am feeling a little irritable, restless, and discontent. Sounds almost clinical. Doesn't feel like that, does it? Irritable. I want to hurt you. Restless just means, well, I'm going to go over here. Nope, that's not it. Maybe over here. Nope, that's not working. Nope, yep, there you go. Maybe I'll get some ice cream. God, I'm getting fat. You know, I'm like a dog circling his tail just looking for the right place to lay down. Nope, 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 nope. People watch restless people and go, what's with Don? He's restless. No kidding, you know. And I'm discontent. Discontent is misunderstood. Discontent sounds like I'm not happy. Happy comes and goes. I can live with happy coming or going. Right? Content or discontent are very, very powerful and very, very different than happy. Happy seems to be influenced a lot on things outside of me. The weather, how kind of mood you're in, what's going on at the time. But contentment can't be messed with. Real contentment is not moved by outside stimuli. And discontentment cannot be comforted by outside stimuli. It is beyond reach. And when an alcoholic becomes discontent, what we're really trying to say is we have an utter inability to experience joy in a sober state. That's a tough pill to swallow. And a lot of us suffer from it sober early in Alcoholics Anonymous because we come here not understanding the spiritual malady that we suffer from. So we have a list in our mind, whether we're sharing it with our sponsor or not is irrelevant. We have a list. And on one list is the trouble we're in, the consequences of the actions we took while we were drinking. And it's the debt and the legal trouble and the family trouble and all that. And it's this list. And we say to ourselves, if that list was repaired, I'd be happy. And there's another list of things that we can't even imagine to have. We go, God, if that stuff ever happened to me, if I ever got the right woman and the right house and the right money and the right job and all those things, and you look at the list and on the line, there's a line at the bottom that says, equals happy. I would be so happy. And we come to Alcoholics Anonymous, we try to turn it into a self-help program. I know I did, and I got out of the trouble. And I got the right woman, check that off. And I got the right job, check that off. And make the money, and I check that off. And get the right house, and I check that off. Now I'm 4 and 5 years sober, and down the bottom where it says equal happy, I ain't happy. And I'm discontent. And I think I'm doing everything Alcoholics Anonymous asks you to do. And I'm at means. How you doing, Don? Oh, I'm great. I'm doing terrific. Any better, I go on a shooting spree. I begin to understand the spiritual malady called alcoholism has a lot more to do with drinking alcohol or not drinking alcohol. I think that irritable, restless, and discontent, described in the doctor's opinion, is talking about new people. That's something when you're new, right? And you just quit for the first time. After a while, that doesn't happen. Let me tell you. I don't grow along spiritual lines. I don't live by spiritual principles. I don't take the simple actions I'm asked to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I become irritable, restless, and discontent very quickly. It's 24 years sober. Now, I don't go out and take a drink. There's way too much between me and the door at this point. There's a lot of stuff I got to swim through to get a drink. But irritable and restless and discontent won't make me take a drink the first day. It'd take a long time. I'll waltz away from my recovery. I'll waltz away from the spiritual actions until I find myself far enough away from you where it sounds good in my head. And I've watched people do it. And I don't want to be one of those guys. I understand that I am the problem today and the answer is God. I did not know that when I got here. I thought that God was going to help me with my alcoholism. God is not helping me with anything. I am powerless. He is all powerful. I need to get out of the way and let him do what he does and let me do what I do, which is be an instrument of his and help his kids in the conversation. God, as I understand him, is management and I am labor. I'll take that irritable, restless, and discontent when I'm out there on my own before AA as long as I can take it. And then I'll pick up a drink and I'll go on a spree. and I'll tear my life and your life apart, and I'll emerge from that spree, and I'll be remorseful. I can't believe I did it again. I can't believe I hurt you again. I can't believe I did those things I promised I wouldn't do, and I meant it when I said it. I'm sorry. Give me another chance. And I have a firm resolution not to drink anymore, not to do it again, not again. I can't live this way. And when I say it, I mean it. I'm telling you the truth. I'm not in denial. I'm not lying. I think every promise I ever made while I was out there, I meant it when I said it. But you see, there's no room for truth where the game of alcoholism is played out because we think that we have some will left. We think we have a card to play. It doesn't matter that I don't want to hurt my family anymore. It doesn't matter that I don't want to go back to jail. You know, my alcoholism doesn't care about that. It's got one job only. That's get another drink. It's going to get the drink. It's got all the time in the world in my head to work with. That's just playground. There's nothing I can do about it. Silkwood promised me that. He said, this is repeated over and over and over again. Until what? Until jails, institutions, insanity, or death. Unless something big happens in my life. Something big's going to have to happen. Something bigger than human power is going to happen to my life. And I'm trying out there. I'm doing everything I can. I remember 1985, 6 years before I get sober, I think L.A.'s my problem. You know, how can I stop drinking in L.A.? I've got this reputation. I'm a party guy. I'm Johnny Saturday Night. You can't, you know, all these loady friends. That's the problem. So I moved to Boston. Found out, much to my chagrin, they drink in Boston. And I'm in Boston for 3 years until I wear out my welcome, you know, and I come back to L.A. and I get the best job I've ever had in my life. And I don't mean the best job while I was drinking. I mean, to date, it's the best job I've ever had. Alcoholics are remarkable. We are like a cat flung outside a second-story window. Yeah! And we land on our feet, boom, in a three-piece suit at a job interview. And we get the job. We can get the job, get the girl, get the money, get the... We just can't keep any of it. I mean, it's really... And I lost that job due to my drinking, and I played the victim card. I called up my beautiful sister, Patricia, in Simi Valley, California, and I said, they threw me away after all I've done for them. And my sister said I'd come live in her house and get on my feet. She said, but you can't drink in my house because everybody knows I'm a drunk. And I told my beautiful sister, I won't drink, I promise. And when I said it, I meant it. But there's no room for truth where the game of alcoholism is played out. And I drank every day in that house for 7 months till I got sober. And if you don't know how you do that when they're watching you, maybe you're not a sneaky rat like I am. I got no problem drinking around your schedule. I'm unemployed. What time do you go to work in the morning? 7 a.m., bars open. And I'm not drinking to kid myself I'm better looking than I am or to have courage to ask some pretty girl to dance. I'm doing oblivion drinking. I'm doing light switch drinking. Let's get it in and on as hard and fast as we can to shut off the head so we can go into a blackout. So I can come to in a room I'm mooching off of my family to face the hideous four horsemen. Terror, frustration, bewilderment, despair. Sitting on the end of the bed, talking to me in my voice in my head, asking me questions, making statements. Who are you going to hurt today, Don? Who are you going to rip off today? You've taken every good thing that's ever come your way and you've torn it to shreds and now you're stealing from your family. You're breaking their heart. How's it going to end for a guy like you? You're a loser. And I don't know what you do with a head like that when you're hungover, but I just took another pull off the bottle and I swore it was going to end that way. I got an unemployment check a few days before I got sober. I went up to my brother-in-law, Larry, and I said, Larry, may I borrow your car? Larry asked me a funny question. He said, Don, will you be coming back this time? Fair question. Our 12 and 12 says my outstanding characteristic as an alcoholic is defiance. So I got Larry's face and said, Larry, how dare you? You know, the last time this happened, I apologized to you. You know, I opened my heart to you, Larry. I don't need this crap. And Larry, untreated Al-Anon that he was, felt terrible and takes the keys out. And I snatch the keys from this man who I'm mooching a room off. I leave his house to get in his car, and I remember thinking there better be gas in it. The delusions of entitlement that I suffer from just really don't have any boundaries. I go to the liquor store to cash my unemployment check because that's where drunks of my type cash our unemployment checks. I'm in line and I have what our book refers to as the thought that precedes the first drink. In my head, it always sounds like this. I'll get a half pint. What's a half pint? I get the half pint. I decide that works so well. I get another half pint. I drink that. I decide I can go visit those friends in the valley, and I'll be back in 45 minutes. They won't even miss me, and I'm gone. 3 days later, I'm driving up the hill to face that family I'd done over one more time. I've taken their hope, their faith, and their trust, and I've torn it to shreds. You need to understand this. Driving up the hill to see that family I've done over again, I love them no less than I love them this very moment. I love my family tremendously, but I can't serve two masters. I only got time to serve one, and that's King Alcohol. And you get between me and a drink, it's nothing personal. It's almost businesslike. I'm getting to the drink. I'm going around you, through you, lying to you, manipulating you, but bet your bottom dollar I'm getting to the drink. But when you don't understand what you suffer from, you don't understand that that's predestined, that you've lost the power of choice, you don't know how to explain that to people. You don't know how to warn them and say, stay away from me. I feel like I'm possessed. I don't know what's happened to me. I don't mean to do these things. Save yourself. I say things like, I'm so sorry. I don't mean to treat you this way. I don't want to live this way. They're watching it, and it's tearing them apart. And I'm living it, and it's my life, and I'm taking the actions. And I feel like somebody else is pulling the strings, and I can't do anything about it. And it got hard for my family to give me those second and those third and those 30th chances when I just roared through their life over and over again. I walk into a house that's been devastated by the disease of alcoholism to find that my brother-in-law wanted to report the car stolen, and my sister has negotiated him down to a missing persons report, and the Simi Valley police are on their way up to do the follow-up investigation. Now, I don't know if you've ever been up for 3 days drinking and doing outside issues, but the police usually aren't who you want to talk to. I got warrants for my arrest in 2 counties, so I start screaming at my sister, you know I got warrants and you called the cops? I'm going to jail. Thanks for nothing, because now it's her fault. I go outside to wait for the police because I don't want the interview to go on in front of the family. I don't know what I'm going to be saying, but I know I'm going to be lying. So, and here come the cops. The black and white unit rolls up, and on the side of the unit it says, canine unit. And I think, oh great, they brought the dog. Like I'm in any shape to make a run for it. And the cop got out and he started asking me those hard, tough questions because they are trained professionals. Like, where were you? And everything I remember is illegal, so I'm lying. I'm making up a story. And he's looking at my eyes really hard because they're like rolling up in my head and they're bouncing around in my eye. And he locks my gaze, so I break his gaze and he breaks with me. So now we're interviewing and dancing and I don't feel good, you know what I mean? And my hands are wet. I just want to divert his attention. And I see the dog in the back seat. And I point at the dog and I go, oh, is that your partner? And he says, why, yes, it is. And he walks over, opens the door, and this dog gets out. German Shepherd. Not a hair out of place. Like a Rin Tin Tin reincarnate. And with no prompting on my part, he started to relay facts to me about the dog's life. Dog's past mandatory retirement. Can't retire him. He's too good. The dog has participated and more arrests than any dog in the history of Ventura County. The dog has participated in more arrests and rescues than any dog in the history of Ventura or Los Angeles County. This dog was so phenomenal that the officers took a collection out of pocket to send him over to Europe for international competition where he kicked butt on German Shepherds, right? Yeah. Yeah. And I said to the cop, I go, that's a phenomenal dog you have there, sir. And this thought flew in the back of my mind, the kind of thought the minute you think it, you know it's true. You want to deny it, but you know it's true. And what the truth was is this dog had done significantly more with his life than I'd done with mine. Hated that dog. I walk into that house that's been devastated by the disease of alcoholism, and they can't look me in the eye anymore. They can't talk to me anymore. My sister's looking at her feet. I asked her later, when you told me to leave your house and not come back, when you told me that you knew I was going to die from the drink and I couldn't die there, why couldn't you look at me? And she said, I couldn't let you lie to my face one more time because my heart was broken. When my sister asked me to leave her house, I guess if I had any self-respect or real love of another human being, I would have understood that. I would have got my gear and cleared out. But I'm an alcoholic, and I'm not too proud to beg, and I begged. I mean, I gave an Academy Award-worthy performance. I turned on the waterworks and everything. I got nowhere to go. I'll die out there. I got to have a couple of days. I'm so sick. Please don't throw me away. I love you. I don't mean to do these things. I'll go to AA and everything. I don't know who said the last part, because that was not on my agenda 24 hours before I got to you. It's not like my sister believed I was going to go to AA. My first week in AA, she took me to AA and picked me up from AA. You know how it makes you feel when you look the way I do and you get in your older sister's compact car at the end of an evening of Alcoholics Anonymous and you're all crunched up going back to her house, 31-year-old loser brother, and she's driving you back, so Donald, what'd you learn in AA tonight? You know, just it's embarrassing. I don't remember my first night in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I remember my second night because I won the lottery. We have a lottery in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's conducted at every meeting. Every open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous has one. A lot of us don't know what's going on, and that's a problem. But I won the lottery my second night in AA. And all over the world tonight in Alcoholics Anonymous, in good AA, this lottery's going on. And in good AA, there's going to be men and women that win the lottery of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's going to be remarkable. Because my second night in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm leaving. I can't be with you anymore. I'm coming up on 48 hours without a drink, and the threads are coming off of my fabric. I'm shaking from the inside out. I just finished attending the 6 o'clock meeting at the Simi Valley Alano Club, and now I'm waiting for the 8 o'clock meeting to start, and I got my back against the wall. I got greasy hair down the middle of my back. I got a full beard with food stuck in it. I've lost the ability to speak the King's English. I communicate in a series of hand gestures, grunts, and clicks. I'm wearing my sunglasses at night. I've got my arms folded like a tough guy, and I'm daring you to come talk to me, and you're staying away from me because you are wise to, because I am terrified, and anybody terrified is dangerous, and I am dying from the disease of alcoholism in the middle of a clubhouse of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I ain't going to make it. Every fiber of my being is screaming to go get a drink. Every thought that I have is go get a drink. These people aren't like you. They don't understand you. Look how clean they are. They're laughing at you. Go get yourself a drink, Don. You're going to do it anyway. How much pain are you going to take? Because you always drink. You always drink. You always drink. You know you're going to do it. You might as well do it now. Bypass the pain. Go get a drink. And I'm leaving to go get a drink. And it's the most important moment of my life on a Tuesday night in the Simi Valley Alano Club because I'm dying of alcoholism and I'm going to leave Alcoholics Anonymous and I'm going to go get drunk. And that window of opportunity that allowed me to get into a meeting is closed behind me and that might be my last chance at sobriety. And I can't take the pain. And although it's the most important moment of my life, over in the corner are Mark and Lou. And Mark and Lou are card-carrying members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it may be the moment, seconds and inches, life or death for Don, but for Mark and Lou, it's Tuesday. And Mark and Lou are where they are every Tuesday, and every Wednesday, and every Thursday. They're hanging out between the 6 o'clock and the 8 o'clock meet at the Simi Valley Alano Club. And they've got their eyes trained on the door. And they got their eyes trained on the room. And they're looking for Newman, the 12-step. And the story goes that Mark looked at Lou and went, whoa. And Lou looked at Mark and went, yeah. And Mark said, I bet we can't get him sober. And Lou said, well, we're here anyway. And they did something for me that I hope I never forget. It seems like such a nicety, it's such a politeness that I think we underestimate it's important in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have the opinion that it's the most important thing that occurs at the meeting. It's more important than the format, what literature we're reading from, who's dating who, who's taking time. It's the most important thing that happens in a good meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Two card-carrying members of Alcoholics Anonymous took a 30-foot walk across a clubhouse to welcome cordially a man dying from alcoholism, to welcome him cordially. I don't think we've met you. My name is Lou. This is Mark. Are you new? Would you like to come sit with us? It sounds like such a nicety, and let me tell you why it's the most important thing that happens. 30 feet from Mark and Lou, you expect me to make that journey to them? I can't do it. It's a million miles. Don't you know what I've done? Don't you know who I am? Don't you know who I've hurt? I've taken every good thing in my life and I've screwed it up. Nobody wants to talk to me. Everyone that's had the misfortune of caring about me has been stung by my disease. I can't get my eyes off of my shoes. And you want me to go shake hands? No. No, Mark and Lou understood the disease of alcoholism. They knew they had to carry the message to this alcoholic. They didn't expect me to do anything but receive it. And they sat me down at a table and they got me a half a cup of coffee. And Mark sat down with me and Lou clapped me on the back. He said, "Don, this is Mark. Mark will be your sponsor." And he walked away. And they assigned me my first sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know that's not done everywhere, but it's probably a good idea in my case, because we say things in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love this. You picked up on this, man. I love it. We say stuff, we don't even think about it. You know, they said it to us, we're saying it to the next generation, we don't even think about it. Every meeting I go to in the format, we talk about sponsorship. Get a sponsor, get a sponsor, get a sponsor. And we say crazy stuff to newcomers, like, find somebody that has what you want. Gee, I wonder what I want my second night in Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, I don't know, maybe a pharmaceutical rep with a spare Cadillac, you know, it's a beginning. Because I'd have never picked the weenie boy they assigned to me, trust me. He's everything I'm not. He's clean cut, he's clean clothed, he's clear eyed, and he loves God, and he's got something that I don't have for anything in the universe, let alone God in Alcoholics Anonymous. He's reverent. You can feel the reverence coming off him for AA and God. And that stuff that floats around AA, I don't talk to the new man about God till he gets his feet underneath him. I don't want to scare him away. My sponsor did not get that memo. My first meeting with him, he was talking about God, what God did for him, what God did for you, what God did for them, what God was going to do for me. He was expecting a miracle, and isn't this great? We're the lucky ones, Don. We made the Alcoholics Anonymous. They're out there in the streets tonight, and they're dying. We're in here safe and sane. We're the lucky ones. Isn't this great? I'm not even 48 hours sober. I'm like, I guess so, you know. He got me a meeting directory, and without my permission, I might add, he started telling me the meetings I would be attending. How do I know that? Because he said, these are the meetings you'll be attending. And he started circling. Circling, circling, circling. I remember thinking, that's a lot of circling. At one point, he stopped talking and circling and said, are you working? Well, no, I'm currently unemployed. More circling, more circling, more circling. Got me a big book, got me a 12 and 12, got me busy. Got me busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got big problems, man. I got warrants for my arrest in two counties. I'm $100,000 in debt, 80 of it to the IRS. I haven't worked in a year. I haven't had a valid driver's license in 10 years. I've never had a checking account. I'm an alcoholic slash loser. I'm talking to my sponsor about my big deals. What am I going to do about all this trouble I'm in? He goes, oh, that's the trouble? You think that's the problem? I go, yeah, I think it's fairly significant. He goes, you're wrong. You only got one problem. That's that you suffer from something called alcoholism, which means you got something that wants nothing less than to kill you slowly and take a large bite out of anyone that has the misfortune of caring about a loser like you. And Don, we'll let you know when these other things are problems. And what I heard was I didn't have to pay back the IRS. I'm going to 14 meetings a week at the Simi Valley Alano Club. I got a sponsor that's at most of them. We're working the steps. He teaches me all three sides of the triangle simultaneously without telling me that's what he's doing. He taught me how to be a service. He didn't tell me to go over there and help somebody. He was already doing it. He said, come keep me company while we set up this meeting. Come keep me company while we clean up this meeting. Come keep me company while we put out the literature. Come keep me company while we make the coffee. He didn't give me commitments and then watch me do them and grade me on them. He was doing the work and he let me share that. He did the Tom Sawyer of Alcoholics Anonymous. He made it look so good, I had to argue with him. Well, let me help. When do I get the mop? Soon, newcomer, soon. You know, just reeling me right in. Fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous without my permission. It just happened. I didn't even know. I had a sponsor who was enthusiastic. He was on fire with Alcoholics Anonymous. I just stood next to him for too long, too many days in a row. One day I just burst into flames. I mean, that's what happens, man. You can't stop at spiritual enthusiasm. You get around spiritual enthusiasm, you get someone that's actually doing the deal, not talking about the deal. Doing the deal, not talking about the deal. Inviting you into their life, inviting you into their vehicle and their home. And he got me fired up about Alcoholics Anonymous. He didn't care what I thought. God, there was a guy in the clubhouse named Smitty. I didn't like Smitty from the day I met him because I mispronounced the word. I mispronounced altruistic, and Smitty corrected me. He made the death list. You know what I mean? When you're new, well, I'm going to have to kill Smitty. Embarrass me on a public level. I think God's going to save you. I'm just going to kill you and make amends later. That's what I'm going to do. One day after the second meeting, my sponsor said, we're going to go move Smitty's couch. I said, Smitty's a jerk. He goes, he is, but we're moving his couch. And we moved Smitty's couch, man. I won't look at Smitty. I won't talk to Smitty. But I moved his couch, and we get done. Smitty comes up to me and goes, man, kid, I want to tell you something. You know, I'm not as young as I used to be, and I couldn't have done this without you. I want to tell you I really appreciate it. He gave me a big hug. You know, hey, hugs. And I thought, oh, no. Oh, now I can't hate him, you know. Man, I got big deals every day. I'm wearing my sponsor out. I'm wearing them out, man, because I'm crazy, man. I'm sober. Just because I'm in AA doesn't mean that I don't go crazy when I don't drink. I haven't finished my step work. I haven't done anything. I've just put the plug in a jug, and I'm around you and your recovery. It kind of annoys me because you've gotten well. You've done the work. I haven't yet. I'm still crazy, and you just smile at me because I'm entertaining, you know. And I'm ill-behaved. I'm ill-behaved in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't think the first step was powerless over alcohol. My life become unmanageable. I thought there was this other first step, and it happened at the end of every meeting. It was my sponsor looking at me and going like this with his finger. And then he pulled me outside and then tell me what grievous miscarriage of justice I had performed in Alcoholics Anonymous. Apparently, there's a whole list of things we don't do in AA. That's not in print, Don. When you're in a meeting, you don't like what they're sharing, you can't go in the corner and do push-ups. Don, you can't get up and get coffee four times during the meeting. Don, you can't get up and go to the bathroom six times during the meeting. Don, you can't threaten old-timers and say you'll make amends later. Don, this went on and on and on. It was just unreasonable. Everybody's complaining to my sponsor about me. I mean, one guy came up to my sponsor and said, will you please do something about your gorilla? You know, it's just... But I'm not drinking, man, and the days are going by, and I'm doing good, and my sponsor, man... My sponsor was like this hard-working, spiritual kind of Yoda ninja warrior type. You know what I mean? He was so kind and so sweet, but at the same time, sometimes he would just slide the blade in. You know what I mean? You wouldn't even feel it go in. And he comes to me one day and he goes, hey, man, what are you doing? Because I'm getting sober in my family's house. The family's been devastated by alcoholism. I'm getting sober in their house. So he comes to me one day and goes, what are you doing to say thank you to that family you've treated so terribly? They're letting you get sober in their house. What are you doing to say thank you? I said, well, I'm not drinking. He goes, that's mighty big of you. He goes, go home tonight and ask your sister if there's anything you can do for her. I went home that night and I said, well, my sponsor wants to know if there's anything I could do to say thank you. And she didn't miss a beat. She said, well, you can paint my house. And I said, your whole house? And she said, yeah. So I went up to my sponsor and I said, this crazy woman wants me to paint her 3,800 square foot two-story house. And he said, is she buying the paint? And I go, well, I assume. He goes, oh, you got off easy. Paint her house. And he always did this thing where he'd tell me something, he'd walk away real dismissively, like the conversation's over. Yeah, paint her house. And he walks away. And it pissed me off. So I yelled at the back of his bald head. I said, hey, I thought this program was suggested. That was a mistake. Because I didn't know he could move like that. I mean, he was like back in my personal space before I even realized it, you know. And he's all up in here looking up at me, and I'm looking down at him, and he's pointing that finger at me, and he said, Don, you're so sick that from this point forward, everything that comes out of my mouth, I want you to assume it's a direction. And we'll let you know when you've passed into the suggestion phase of the program. My sponsor was a big book guy, man, and he understood the amends process. And even though I wasn't on the amends, and I argued with that too, you know, I'm not even on the ninth step yet. He know what they say, we're going to make a special exception just for you. And But he knew I couldn't sleep at night. And he knew I couldn't be in the same room with my sister at the same time. And she's like my best friend on the planet. But my drink and my alcoholism had driven a wedge between us and caused so much pain. And she was trying to have faith and trying to have hope, and I didn't know what to do. And my sponsor, being a student of the Big Book, understood the most important word in the amends process in the Big Book is the word demonstration. It's used in two different places. In the first place, it says, our man will be more interested in a demonstration of goodwill than our talk of spiritual discoveries. Later on, it says, it doesn't matter if somebody throws us out of his office. It's water over the dam. We've made our demonstration. But he was big on that demonstration of goodwill or the amends. See, what I want to do is I want to come to you when I get sober and I want to say, I'm sorry I stole your car, stole your dough, broke your heart, but I'm sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and I got God. We're all cool, right? My sponsor got the big book out and said, I'll be like the farmer coming out of his cyclone cellar to see the devastation of his farm, only to remark, don't see anything wrong here, Ma, and Grand, the wind stopped blowing. No, there was a long period of reconstruction ahead, and we must take the lead. A mumbling apology that we are sorry will not fit the bill. So I'm painting her house. And I'm bitter. Bitter! But the further I got into that project, amazing things started to happen. My sister and I started to be in the same room, being able to breathe the same air and look at each other and be able to talk a little bit. And when I got done painting her house, we weren't even Stephen, but you know what? Alcoholics Anonymous and the amends process, before I even did it, and without my permission, by a sponsor pushing me through that, had given me back somebody that I love very much and given me back my relationship with my sister. And I owe that to the amends process and Alcoholics Anonymous. And that demonstration of goodwill and strong sponsorship. I can't take credit for the good life I have today. I have to give it all to sponsorship. Sponsors have saved my bacon time and time again. You know why sponsorship works so good? Does my sponsor have to be smarter than me, faster than me, stronger than me? I don't believe so. I believe anybody can sponsor me if I'm willing. If they're grounded in Alcoholics Anonymous, have a relationship with a God of their own understanding, and believe in this thing, there's only one requirement to sponsor a guy like me. You can't have my emotions about my life. Because I'm an alcoholic. I'm grandiose and I'm full of fear at any given moment. You know why my sponsor was able to tell me, hey, Don, we're going to court to clean up your records? Because he wasn't going to jail. I mean, he told me, we're going to court, be outside at 8 o'clock, I'm picking you up. I was trying to figure out what I did to piss him off. I didn't sleep all night. I got in his truck, we're driving to Van Nuys Court, he's in the best mood I've ever seen him in. I haven't slept all night because I'm going to jail. At one point he looks at me and he goes, Donna, you need to understand something. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was in a great deal of trouble. Now you're in trouble. I got to tell you, this is better. You know? If you got a sponsor that cares, get another sponsor, man. That'll kill you, man. My sponsor just didn't care. When I almost tearfully explained to my sponsor that I owed the IRS $80,000, he goes, that's okay. Lots of people owe money. That's a lot, but it'll be okay. And he immediately put that to service in Alcoholics Anonymous. Seemingly for years after that, if anybody had any newcomer had the audacity to complain about their little weenie $1,500 debt to the IRS, my sponsor would say, hold that thought for a minute. Hey, Don, come over here for a minute. I'd come across the clubhouse. I'd stand there. He goes, Don, tell Billy here how much you owe the IRS. I go, I owe the IRS $80,000. And Billy goes, Jesus, I just want to be in service. And but we don't care. Whatever you got, we'll put it to service. We don't care. There's nothing here. There's no trouble we haven't seen or we've overcome. And sponsorship has saved my life time and time again. Man, I remember I was working construction and I sucked at construction. I mean, I'd love to tell you I found out my true calling was to work with my hands. I'd be lying. I was a terrible construction worker. I had a nickname on the job site, the bleeder. You know, I was terrible. And I've worked my steps and I'm making my amends and I'm, oh my God, I start paying the IRS back, man. I'm making minimum wage with taxes taken out. And I'm 2 years sober, man. I don't want to call the IRS, man. How am I going to pay them off? Well, I'm $80,000, man. How is this going to work? And I remember one day the fear got so big, I was more afraid of the IRS than the fear of being broke, man. And I called the IRS up and I made arrangements. Give them $100 a month. I knew I'd never pay them off. But I got to start somewhere, man. And I wrote that first check for $100. I remember thinking, oh, good. 79,900 to go. But it's like I started making amends to the IRS, man, and it's like suddenly I started getting better jobs. I had this weird opportunity to go into another industry and do sales, straight commission. I thought it was a loser's game. I wasn't even going to go apply. But I had strong sponsorship in my life, so I called my sponsor about the job I wasn't going to go apply for. And he said, well, I want you to apply. And I said, but I don't want to. He goes, that's so funny. I don't remember asking you what you wanted. Oh, I know where that goes, right? All right, tough guy. So I go and apply, and they hire me on the spot. On the spot. And I go, now what do I do? He goes, well, you go to work for them. And I mean, they start sliding me $500 a week against commissions I don't have. So I work for the company for 3 months, and I owe them $5,000. I call my sponsor, but go, man, we need to cut and run, like now. And my sponsor wouldn't let me quit the job because my boss was happy with me. My boss said, nobody sells at first. So he says, you get to stop going when they stop inviting you back. And I thought he was an idiot. Man, and I was a terrible salesman. I'm reading every sales book you can get, so I'm neurotic, and I'm just like, every day I'm a different salesman because I'm trying a different sales technique. I'm trying everything but trusting God and being Don, you know what I mean? And one day, man, I hit the wall. I met this lady. I measure her roof. I'm talking to her. I come down. Everything's going great. And I remember this thing I read in the sales book, instant identification. Find something about them quickly. You know, if they got a dog, you love dogs. If they fish, you fish. What a coincidence. Instant identification. And I see her. She's obviously pregnant. So instant identification. I say to her, I go, how far along are you? And everything was going great, you know. And I said that, and her whole face changed. She said, what do you mean? Now, anybody with any brains would have dropped the shovel and stopped digging, but I'm an alcoholic. I just dig harder. Well, you're praying it, aren't you? She says, no. And the smart voice in my head says, drop the shovel, but I'm an alcoholic. I start digging harder. Did you have a kid recently? 2 years ago. I said, thanks for the opportunity to earn your business. I went out to my truck and banged my head on the steering wheel for 5 minutes going, stupid, stupid, stupid. I'm begging my sponsor to let me quit the job. He won't let me quit it. Long story short, here I stand. I've been in that industry over 20 years, and I love my job, and I'm good at it. I didn't know that when you get into a new industry or you do anything for the first time or you're learning something, you're supposed to suck at it. I didn't know that. And if anything's hard, I just run away from it, man. My sponsor wouldn't let me run away. My beautiful wife, Eileen, next June, we'll celebrate 20 years of marriage. Boy meets girl on AA campus, man. I'm blessed. But here's sponsor direction, and that one's the only thing. That's the only relationship a sponsor ever ran. He ran my relationship. I got to tell you, he ran my dating. He ran everything, how long we'd be engaged. He told me this. He goes, Don, I've seen your sex inventory. You're 0-7. He goes, how bad could I screw it up? Let me take a whack at it. It made sense to me, you know. Here we are 20 years later. But even that I tried to screw up. I made an appointment with my sponsor to talk about my relationship about 3 months after I started taking Eileen off. By the way, your sponsors love that. When you call your sponsor up and say, hey, I want to talk about my relationship, this is what they think. Oh, good, hang on, I'll load my pistol. Okay, go ahead. You know. We love that as sponsors. Boy, nothing we'd rather do than hear about your relationship. But I met with him and I said, I'm going to break up with Eileen. And he said, well, why? What's wrong? And I said, oh, nothing. She's perfect. And he goes, well, if she's perfect, why do you want to break up with her? Ah, it's too hard. It's too hard, man. I just love her too much. I'm just obsessed. I think about her all the time. I don't like the way it makes me feel. I like it when they're into me, not when I'm into them. This is, I feel out of control. And he called me a bad name and he refused to let me break up with my then girlfriend. He said, you cannot break up with your girlfriend. If you break up with your girlfriend, get another sponsor. And I was like, you can't tell me that. He goes, well, I just did. And he made me stay, and now we're married 20 years. Sponsor direction, I got 100 stories like that where a sponsor intervened on my behalf because he didn't have my emotions about my life. It works really well. I learned that in the first 30 days, that simple rule. I don't make major decisions without running it by my sponsor, and I still live that way today. It's a funny thing. And I almost missed AA. I thought AA, God, AA takes a long time for you to really see what's here. You know, I had a best friend in AA. His name was Greg, man. He was my best friend in the world. He had 30 days of sobriety when I walked in new. And after the fog lifted, Greg and I found each other, man. We became best friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. We went to tons of meetings together, did tons of service work together. We tried to learn how the normal people had fun. We tried to learn that together. Greg was renting this house, had a swimming pool. I remember one Saturday we bought really nice steaks and we had a beautiful steak lunch. And we took a nice swim in the Southern California sun. And then we were watching a movie that we had rented. And we just like what normal people did. I turned to Greg. I go, hey, man, you having any fun? He goes, nah, not a lick. You know, just trying to learn how to live sober, man. And first 2 years of my sobriety, Greg and I did it shoulder to shoulder. You know what I mean? And Greg started getting a little burned out on clubhouse sobriety and started pulling back a little bit. And I started getting burned out on clubhouse sobriety. But I didn't pull back, man. I'm still going to 14 meetings a week. Now I'm secretary in meetings. I'm sponsoring guys. I'm doing all kinds of crazy stuff, man. Sponsoring guys. I started sponsoring guys when I was 6 months sober. And I didn't want to do that. I didn't finish all my amends yet. You know what I mean? I thought I was inadequate. How can I sponsor somebody? I got 6 lousy months. I don't have a car. I live at my sister's house. And I mean, my sponsor said I had to do it. A guy asked me to sponsor him. I told the guy I'd get back to him. My sponsor bit my head off. He said, go say yes. And I said to my sponsor, I said, hey man, I don't want to kill him. And he said, you got to kill a couple before you get the hang of it, you know. And just... I'm telling you, man, our slogan, AA, we care. No, we don't. We're not worried about killing alcoholics. You can't kill an alcoholic. We're the cockroaches of humanity. Come on. So I'm as busy as you can be in Alcoholics Anonymous and be 2 years sober. My buddy Greg, man, he starts pulling back. And everything's coming up roses for Greg, man. He's got a degree in engineering. He's got this job making fat money. He found a girl in AA before I did, you know, and they're all hooked up. You're at playing house, and he's down to 2 meetings, 3 meetings a week. I'm going to 14. I'm helping everybody with everything. I'm young in sponsorship. You know how that is. It's all ego. You know, you're stacking newcomers on top of each other. See how big you can make yourself, and they don't appreciate you, so you threaten them all the time. Oh, I was a fun sponsor, but I was around a lot, so it was helpful. And now I'm 3 years sober, and I'm 4 years sober, and I'm super active in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm grinding, man. I'm grinding. I'm doing it by the numbers in AA. I'm trying to get out of debt, and I met Eileen, and we got married, and we're living in a little crappy one-bedroom apartment. We don't have any money. She's making her amends. I'm making my amends. We're trying to save for how, trying to do it by the numbers. You know, we don't declare bankruptcy in AA. We pay the money back. Our sponsors are on our butt about it. We're going to AA every night. Not Greg, man. Greg doesn't even go to AA anymore. And Greg gets married to a girl from AA, man, when he's 4 years sober. She's got like 8 years, man. And it's not an AA wedding. It's just a wedding, man. There's drinking going on there. They're not drinking because they don't drink, man. They know they're alcoholic. I was best man at the wedding. And I'm watching my buddy Greg with the speedboat in his driveway and the two new cars. He builds a house in the Antelope Valley custom home. He's killing it, making all this money. He doesn't go to AA. I'm talking to him about it. Man, you promised me we'd do this forever. He goes, you know what? I just can't take the cycle babble. I can't take all the old timers. You know what? Me and my higher power are going to be fine. By the time I'm 5 years sober, 6 years sober, man, I start thinking I'm the chump. Yeah, my life's gotten better, but it's incremental. And man, I'm in AA every night. You know, I'm in competition with guys that get off work at 5 and then they get to relax, play with their kids, have a little dinner, go to bed. I'm not getting home till 10 o'clock at night. Because I'm in AA because that's what the old timers told me I needed to be. My buddy Greg doesn't have that problem. He's killing it. He's all happy. He's 6 years sober. He didn't even go to AA. Maybe I'm the chump. I'm the AA chump. And I got the call. This is from my first sponsor. He said, hey, man, we got Greg here. He drank, and we 12-stepped him, and he's asking for you. And I threw Eileen in the car, and we drove an hour and a half to where I used to live. And I walked into a dark room, just a few lights on. There were 4 or 5 AA members in there, and in the corner was a guy I couldn't believe that I'd ever really known, because it was Greg, but he didn't look like the Greg I'd remembered. He was much smaller. He was trembling. He had his hand down. He was saying something. I couldn't catch it at first, over and over again. He just kept saying it over and over again. I got closer. As I got closer, I picked up what he was saying. And what he was saying was, is it time yet? Is it time yet? Is it time yet? He just kept saying it over and over again. So I grabbed my grand sponsor. I go, what's he talking about? He goes, oh, man. He goes, he already snapped one seizure. We can't get him into detox till 6 o'clock in the morning. And we're afraid he's going to go into DT, so about every 15 minutes we give him a thimble of vodka to keep him this side of DTs. Is it time yet? Is it time yet? Is it time yet? And I'm watching the man in the grip of alcoholism. I sat down with my best friend in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said, what happened, buddy? And he told me the story. He said there wasn't a cloud in the sky, and him and Kathy were on the veranda looking at their beautiful new cars in front of their beautiful new house, and they said, you know, we're not the same people that came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Kathy said, no, we're not. And Greg said, you know, we could probably handle a drink. And she said, yeah, we probably handle one. And Kathy said, but you know what, Greg, if it gets out of control, promise me we'll go back to AA. And Greg promised. And they went out and they got a bottle of champagne and they poured 2 glasses of champagne from the bottle. And then they poured the rest of the bottle out just in case. And then they drank the glass of champagne and they waited. And nothing happened. And they laughed and they laughed and they laughed at Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, those fear mongers in AA. I had a drink. I don't feel like having another drink. You feel like having another drink? Nope, I don't. Greg comes home from work 2 weeks later and Kathy turns around in the garden. She's drinking a Budweiser. Greg goes, what's with the beer? And she goes, it was hot out. And he goes, yeah, it is hot. You got another one? 2 weeks after that, Greg's drinking himself around the clock. Kathy's drinking around the clock. They go back to AA. Only they can't catch lightning in a bottle. They get sponsors. They go to meetings, but it's not the same. Greg says when you kick 6 years to the curb, it's nothing to kick 17 days. And Greg can't catch lightning in a bottle again. Kathy decides alcohol is not her problem. It's psychiatry, so she goes back on psychotropic medication. She drinks on top of it, has a psychotic break, and tries to kill Greg in a blackout. Greg doesn't know what to do. He's locked up in the bathroom, and she's trying to come through the door with a butcher knife, so he calls the cops. When you call the cops and tell them your wife's got a butcher knife, she's trying to kill you, they send SWAT. And he watched his wife hogtied in front of him in the living room of their beautiful house with the two beautiful cars and thrown in the back of a paddy wagon and taken off to Sybil Brand Institute to await arraignment on trying to kill her husband. And Greg was willing to trade the good he had for the good that could be. And Alcoholics Anonymous became an inconvenience for him. And I don't know whatever happened to my best friend in Alcoholics Anonymous. We tried to get him into detox, and he went and he checked himself out, and I've never seen him again. And every time I travel in Alcoholics Anonymous, in a room like this in a place I don't live, I scan the room and I always look for Greg. And I look for Greg this weekend. And I hope that I find him in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous someday. But he gave me an amazing gift. Because I got to see what alcoholism was. And at 6 years sober, I saw what happens to guys like me when they forget where they came from. And I never want to stop dancing with the partner that brought me. I'm running out of time. I want to tell you a quick story, and I want to sit down. I think it sums up a lot what Alcoholics Anonymous means to me and what's happened to me. 11 years ago, my wife hit the saturation point with Los Angeles, and she said, I can't live here anymore. I want to move to the Pacific Northwest. And we had planned on retiring there, and I reminded her of the plan. And she said, why do I have to wait till I retire to live someplace beautiful? And everything I had was based on money and anything but spiritual, and I knew she was right, and we took the leap. And we left Los Angeles, and we left the bosom of the Pacific group that we'd been in for over a decade and loved, and we moved to Bellingham, Washington. If you don't know where Bellingham is, it's 100 miles north of Seattle. We're 20 miles south of the Canadian border, America's first defense against Canada, you know? And it's beautiful there, man. It's all rivers and streams and lakes and mountains, and we live in the woods, man, and I'm a city kid, you know what I mean? I'm concrete, steel, and glass. And suddenly I found myself in the woods, and it's dark at night. You know what I mean? It's darkety dark dark. I remember the first time I forgot something in the car, man, and I didn't have the porch light on, and I didn't have a flashlight, and I was walking to the car to get something. I got halfway to the car, and a little voice in my head said, Cougar. And I just, oh. Man, I jumped and skedaddled back in the house, slammed the door. I'm against the door. My wife's like, what's with you? I go, don't go out with a flashlight. Dark, dark, darkity, dark, dark. You just... Man, we got wildlife. I know you got deer here, but we're city kids. And when we moved there, they got deer too. And we lost our minds. We got deer in our backyard. We were just freaking out. And then the mama deer showed up in the summer with their little spotted fawns. And we are freaking out, taking pictures and sending them to all our friends and breaking wildlife laws and feeding deer. Just city kids, we're nuts. And this one mama deer, this one little boy deer, he's so cute, had a big scratch across his nose. He must have got into it with one of the bucks or in a chain link fence. And we're city kids, so we named the deer. That's Mama Deer and Scratch. Mama Deer and Scratch, you know. And we're just having a fantastic time. We're new to the area. It's just beautiful, dark at night, great deer. And then rutting season comes in the fall, and, you know, the deer start losing their summer coats and putting on their winter coats, but not Scratch. Scratch is looking a little rough, man. He's a little patchy, missing fur here and there. And I mentioned that to Eileen. I'm like, man, Scratch kind of looking ugly. And she goes, yeah, he is. And she's like that girl, man. So she gets on the internet and researches it and reports back to me it's an actual affliction. That where we live, the deer get a thing called deer hair loss syndrome. And if they lose enough of their fur, and it only happens in their first year, and if they lose enough of their fur, winter comes. And they can't eat enough to keep their furnace going. They get hypothermic and they die. I said to Eileen, I go, Scratch is going to die? She goes, yeah. I go, oh, not on our watch. And we lost our mind, you know. We start breaking laws. We're doing supplemental feeding. I'm going to the feed store and putting 4 50-pound sacks of Cobb and molasses in my Toyota Avalon and driving it home. The guy's going, how many heads you got? I'm like, I don't know, how many head would it feed? And he goes, like two? And I go, I got two. I'm lying. And we're obsessed, you know, and you can't feed the one sick deer, right? You set up feeding stations. So now we got 15, 20 deer from all over. And I'm trying to, like, herd the deer. It's like, let the sick one eat. You're selfish, you know. And so we're going through hundreds of pounds of feed so we can just get this one little, and it's not working. He's losing more and more fur. And I go to work, and I call Eileen from work, and I go, did Scratch show up? She'd go, yeah, he showed up. I go, how's he look? She goes, not good. And I go, not this one, God. I'd shake my fist and just obsessed with this deer. And poor Scratch, man, he lost all his fur except from the nap of his neck to the end of his rump, man. He had this 4-inch mohawk running right down the middle of his back. And by now, we fed him so much, he's just rounded out like a beer keg. So he just sits in the backyard, this ugly mohawk, fat. All I do is eat and poop, baby deer. And I'm obsessed with this deer. And Scratch makes it to spring and he doesn't die. And for the next 3 years, every rutting season, about this time of year, Scratch would show up in our backyard. This magnificent buck, this huge rack. He'd walk up to my wife. My wife would feed him apples by hand. And I'd watch that and I'd think to myself, what was it about that damn deer that made me lose my mind? And one day it hit me. I'm that damn deer. I'm that guy standing in the corner of the Simi Valley Alano Club where anybody with a glancing familiarity with alcoholism would have taken one look at me and would have said, that guy over there, he's going to die. And two card-carrying members of Alcoholics Anonymous named Lou and Mark were in the other corner, and they looked at each other and said, not on our watch. And they did what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And they carried the message to the alcoholic that still suffers. And I know this as much as I know anything. Bill and Bob are gone, and they've left us a beautiful, tremendous legacy. But they can't do the work for us. And I know this as much as I'm standing here. It's our watch now. And I know this also, that right now, tonight, while we're in here, safe, sane, and sober in Columbus, Georgia, they're out there on the streets tonight, and they are dying. And they are coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. They don't even know it yet. But they're running out of hope and they're running out of time and they're going to run out of ideas. And one day they're going to find themselves in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, searching, looking for what they don't know, but they don't know where else to go. And they're going to walk into our respective home groups, lost and broken like we were. And the question we have to ask ourselves when they arrive at our respective home groups, where are we going to be? And how are we going to be? Are we going to be in the room watching the door for the new man or woman? Or are we going to be in the room with our buddies cutting up, talking about the football game, talking about our latest money deal, talking about what we do? Are we going to leave that crap outside of Alcoholics Anonymous where it has no place when we cross the spiritual threshold of a meeting of alcoholics and remember that when we walk into a room, we're on duty and it's our watch. And they're coming to us and they're looking for a new life. And I have to remember that when I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous at my home group where my friends are, my buddies are, and I want to talk to these guys, I got to keep my eye on the door and I got to go up to the new guys and I got to give them what I was given, a cordial welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous and see what I can do to help meet their needs. Because they did it for me and it changed and saved my life. And if I owe nothing else, I owe that to Alcoholics Anonymous. I got to tell you, let's remember, it's our watch now. They're coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. They're looking for us. I hope we stay sober forever. Thanks for listening.